Okay, so 5 years old, and instead of hanging around chit-chatting after church, you break with the quickness and do the unthinkable. We go to the grocery store, way against the rules of our religion to shop on the Sabbath, but that's just the beginning. Mom and pops whispering to each other about the weatherman said the biggest storm ever is bearing down on northern Michigan. And living in the middle of nowhere, a town called Shea Lake, we gotta get back before it hits. Inside the grocery store, my jaw drops open. Mother snatches two packages of peanut butter cookies and puts it in our basket. My little brother looks at me in wonder. Cookies? We never get stuff like cookies. Then Mom's follows it up by throwing in a package of hot chocolate. Lord! Mom and Dad are frantic, throwing stuff in the cart. Meat, bread, canned beans, cheese, whatever. We pay. Run out to load up. The sky swirls, Michigan slate gray. Snow descending in white walls. Barely visible car in the parking lot. We take off. Dad focuses on the road like a prayer. I know he wants to floor it, but we can barely see 3 feet ahead. It's like the snow starts at the ground and just rises forever to the sky. Minutes pile on. We pull off Highway 24. Hear the hard rumble of road and rock and salt on Clifford Road. Feel the car lose traction and catch, but we inch on. Threading down one tiny rural road after another. 10 miles an hour, 5 miles an hour, and then almost gentle, the car stops. The wheels spin, but we're not going anywhere. I'm so scared. Mom and Dad bundle us up with every piece of clothing in the car. It's gonna be fine, babies, don't worry. Then we go out into the blizzard. Pops leads the way, takes big steps in the snow. My mother puts her foot where he puts his, and we follow step, 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 and I can't see in front of me. I can't see my mother in the white blackness, and I scream, Mama! And my father snatches me up in his arms, grabs my little brother, and step, step, blizzard trying to tear our little family off the road, step, step, and I hear Pops breathing hard. So I hold on to him tight as I can, my brother squeezing the other side, step. Mama behind us, step. Storm raging, step, step. Until finally, after trudging almost a mile through this blizzard, we make it to the front door of our little cottage. And I don't know how he carried us that long through the madness. I just don't know. Mom's strips us down as Dad gets the fire going. She wraps us in blankets and sits us in front of the fire. And Mom's has actually brought a package of the hot chocolate. She fixes it up. And my brother and I sit giggling at each other, each of us with a mug of cocoa in front of the fire. Then the door opens to a blast of blizzard. And my father walks back out into the darkness. We look at my mother. You just gotta get the groceries, baby. Don't worry. And now, 30 years later, I see that whole scene, fever dream clear. My head bent over the toilet, emptying my convulsing stomach again. Entire body shivering from whatever this is. I hear my babies screaming in the next room. One 7 months old, the other 2 years old. And how did I get children? What am I doing with them alone, barely able to lift my head off this toilet bowl? I start feeling sorry for myself. And then I remember, step, step, step. And if he can do that, I can do this. Crawl into the bedroom. Fix one a bottle, read the other one a story. I can barely move, and I would laugh at myself, but it would hurt too much. But the babies start laughing. And yeah, It does hurt, but I can't help but laugh along with them. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, we proudly present Full Circle. Amazing stories from real people who ended up exactly where they started in the first place. My name is Lynn Washington. Please hold your enemies close and your babies closer. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snap. Now, sensitive listeners should know that our first story does contain some graphic imagery, but you should hear it anyway. It starts off in the American War in Vietnam with a young soldier who spends day after sweltering day in the jungle looking for the North Vietnamese Army, the NVA. Snap Judgment.
Basically, what we did was we moved up and down the trails and we were looking for what we call meeting engagements, the NVA and I and my platoon or my company. The thing about it is you would go sometimes 2, maybe sometimes 3 weeks in a row without seeing anybody. In fact, after about a week or a week and a half, you started to get nervous because you knew you were overdue, you know? And then all of a sudden, the world would explode. Things are calm, peaceful, and all of a sudden people are dying left and right. You don't think you're going to be alive 2 seconds from now. And then all of a sudden it's quiet, it's over with. You pull back to a position you can defend, organize, get your medevac your wounded out, and then you usually spend that night in that location, and then the next day you get up and you just start it all over again.
Homer had been marching up and down the Vietnamese hills for 7 months. One night, after a particularly gruesome engagement, he was feeling strung out and on edge, so he drank pretty much a whole bottle of Chivas Regal, and he passed out a few hours before the sun came up.
And then it was time to get up because the choppers were leaving at 8 o'clock. I had too bad of a hangover to remember much of that morning. But anyway, we got on the choppers and we flew up to the valley. And it's about 105 degrees, so it's really hot. During the rainy season, it's really slippery. I mean, slippery to the point to where you have to literally climb from root to tree trunk to root to tree trunk. It's like grease. You just go, wow, wide open, you know? It's so dark on those ridgelines, on top of those ridgelines, that in the middle of the day, you have to use your flashlight to read a map. That's how dark it is. Walk a little ways, have to stop and take a break because we're about to pass out from the heat. I noticed on the side of the road there was this concrete. They kind of scabbed it with concrete to keep landslides from coming down because apparently it was a landslide-prone area. And as I'm looking, I notice at the top of the ridgeline, there's this huge tree. I mean, it's triple canopy jungle, and this tree is like maybe 30, 40 feet above all the other trees in the jungle. It's an amazing tree. We had just stopped for a water break, and around the bend in the trail comes this guy out of Soldier of Fortune magazine. Brand new, clean pith helmet, brand new sparkling clean weapon, clean fatigues. I mean, he is spotless. He looked like he was in a photo shoot or something. So I figure at first that I'm hallucinating. I mean, I really thought I was hallucinating. I thought the heat had finally gotten to me. I'd overdone it. And I realized, oh my God, it's the NVA. He's gonna shoot me. He had on this regular North Vietnamese Army fiber helmet. So he was obviously Vietnamese. He had his rifle slung over his shoulder. He was just diddy-bopping. When he first came around the corner, his head was down. He was looking down. He wasn't even looking up, you know. He didn't think there was anybody in the world out there. I yelled at him, "Chu Hoi," because that's what I'd seen on all the surrender pamphlets our PSYOPs people would put out. So I don't know whether that confused him or not. But the point is, he was still trying to get his weapon down and shoot me. So I waited and I waited. And then at the last second, just before he had leveled down it where it was pointed directly at me, I did the typical infantry thing, a 3-round burst. Stitched him one through the abdomen, once literally right through the heart. And I go up, and when I get there, like I say, his hair is perfectly groomed. He's clean. He's out of place. And when I get there, he's still alive enough that he's got life in his eyes. And I got to actually see if you've ever seen someone die, there's a moment where there's no life there anymore. It kind of the glossiness disappears and the tension disappears and you know they're gone. And I saw that. That gets you. I mean, whether it's the bad guy or the good guy, it gets you. I've seen that. I told the squad leader to, check for documents. When we went through his uniform and all, he had some letters home. There were a mathematics notebook and a medical notebook. And we decided that we couldn't take the body because in the heat, we just couldn't haul that much load. So what we did is we took the documents and the weapon and we beat feet. We moved on out.
The next day, when they were waiting for the helicopter that would take them back to base camp, Homer's squad leader handed him the notebook that they had taken off the dead man's body.
And when we got down to the valley the next day, waiting for the helicopters to come in, that's when I got the documents from the squad leader. I was just blown away. He had taken a small notebook, maybe 5 inches wide, 6 inches long, and he had wrapped it with tape so that it would hold together in the jungle. And he had taken 2 or 3 different color pens and markers, and he had drawn anatomical drawings, medical drawings, of nerve and blood vessels and muscle structures and all that kind of stuff that he had copied out of textbooks while he was undergoing training to show to other medics in the field when he was trying to explain things. And I mean, these drawings were so beautiful, they're works of art. I mean, literally. Wow. And then the realization then came to me that he was a medic. And of course, everybody loves, respects, and takes care of the medics on either side. They're the good people in a horrible situation.
Homer took the notebooks. He carefully wrapped them in brown paper, and he mailed them home to his mother.
Other guys sent weapons home as souvenirs. I just thought that would be a good souvenir of my time in combat. I didn't know the significance of it at all. It just looked really cool. Well, by the time I got back at the end of my second tour, and I had completely forgotten about the incident altogether. It was probably 25 years, quarter of a century.
After I retired, then I decided to put up a website about some of my Vietnam experiences and contact my friends. So I asked Mom if she could find the audio tapes, the little cassette tapes that I'd sent back from Vietnam.
And she said, there's a package here in brown paper that you asked me to save but not to open. And instantly I remembered what it was. I mean, it's like I couldn't think, I couldn't move. I do remember I'm trembling right now. I'm trembling. The moment she said the brown paper, it all came back. And all of it came back. I can remember the look in his eye. I can remember the look in his eye when he wasn't alive anymore. The sun was coming in the window. It was late afternoon. And it was wintertime, so it was warm. The first book I opened was the one with the medical drawings in it. Those incredibly beautiful. And they were still just as vibrant and rich color as they had been the day I first saw them. And I thought, I don't know the family or anything about them, but I'm quite certain they would love to get their hands on this.
So Homer decided to try to return the notebook to the family of the man he'd killed. He scanned some pages into his website, and eventually a Vietnamese journalist took the images and printed them in a Vietnamese newspaper. Almost immediately, the family of the fallen soldier came forward to claim the notebook.
My wife and I first knew about his notebook from a newspaper named Education Times that a cousin brought to us, in which they printed several notebooks, and we saw the name there, Hoàng Ngọc Đảm, my brother's name there. We knew for sure that it's him.
The medic's name was Hoàng Ngọc Đảm, or Dom for short, and all his family knew was that he'd never come home from battle. This is Dom's brother-in-law, Hoàng Minh Dieu. He's talking to us through a translator.
When we knew that it was him, we had a very mixed feeling, both sadness, and also some anxiety, but also so glad that we finally found him, and we hope that Homer could himself bring the notebook to us. He was a very good brother, and after the war, I have also tried several occasions to find the remains of my brother-in-law, Hoàng Ngọc Đảm.
Getting back Dom's notebook was getting back a small piece of Dom, which was wonderful. But his family also felt like they were one step closer to finding Dom's lost remains.
Because in the Buddhist tradition, they need to get some part of the body back to the family burial ground.
For us Vietnamese, generally, it's very important to find the remains of the deceased, and it's even more important to find the remains of the soldiers who have fallen in the wars.
The term wandering souls refers to the fact that if they don't get anything back to bury in the burial plot, then they think the soul wanders aimlessly for eternity.
Because there are so many people still missing in Vietnam from the war, a sort of cottage industry has popped up to help connect families with their lost relatives. There are private investigators, a government agency, recovery companies. There are also lots of sort of spiritual guides who offer their services to help families find the missing remains of their loved ones.
The family had contacted, after the war, had contacted a psychic.
Fortune teller is what they call them over there. We've got our psychic mediums here in the States also. But this lady has apparently an incredible reputation for being dead on with her predictions. And they contacted her and asked her about Dom.
The medium said she gleaned a lot of information from the notebooks, spiritual information that could help lead to Dom's remains. And she thought Homer's presence could help them guide the search. So the family asked Homer if he would come back to Vietnam.
When Snap Judgment returns, Homer's surprising decision that changes everything. When the Snap Judgment Full Circle episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Full Circle episode. When last we left, Homer Steely was contemplating the return to Vietnam at the request of the family of the man he had slain in the war. Snap Judgment.
I thought it very important that they have some closure. I kind of said yes before I thought it through. And as it got closer and closer time to go over, of course, my anxiety level went up. I mean, think about it. I'm going back to a foreign country on the other side of the planet.
Going into the home of a family whose son I had killed. I didn't know what to expect. I mean, for all I knew, one of the veterans in the community would shoot me. We got in around midnight, And I got off the plane and I had forgotten how hot it is. The sensations were just like, whoa, okay, I remember this.
After a drive out of the city and through the countryside, Homer walked into Dom's family's home.
Well, when we got there, I initially had a bowl of fruit, which I brought into the family home and placed on the altar. They have an altar in the family home to Dom and his other brother that died in the war also. And they worship their ancestors, their elders, and so they keep a shrine there. And I placed the fruit there. And of course, the younger sisters over there, real scary, right? Howling and grimacing and speaking in tongues, as we would call it.
This is tape that was recorded by an American radio reporter that was with Homer. It was about 10 years ago, and for some reason, this is some of the only tape that still exists from this trip. Another one of Dom's brothers, who goes by Kat, says the woman speaking in tongues was their sister-in-law. He says they think she was channeling another brother who also died in the war, Wang Damchi.
I believe her body was taken by our second brother, Wang Damchi, then.
And all this time I can hear this wailing and this someone saying strange things that even to me didn't sound like Vietnamese. And a lot of really loud wailing, like someone was really upset. And I go in and boy, at that point when I first saw her, I was almost turned around and left. I mean, she was completely out of it. They said she was getting messages from Dom about what was going to happen and what needed to take place and so forth and so on. But she was gesturing and she was arching and her throat was bulging and she was gnashing her teeth and wailing really loud and struggling. And I'm like 2 feet away from her as I walk past to go to the altar, you know. So, boy, that was pretty emotional. And then I get up to the altar and I set the fruit down. And just as I set the fruit down, I see Dom's picture over there. And he's staring at me. I mean, and then I go to the other side of the room and sit down after I've said my little prayers and Roth is sticking on. I go sit down and I sit on the opposite side of the table facing the altar. And again, I look up and he is staring directly at me still. And for the next hour and a half, every time I get distracted a little bit, and I relax, I find myself looking over there, and there he is again. It's like he was, I'm here, I'm glad you made it, you know?
The sister-in-law settled down, and she and the rest of the family and Homer all sat down to put together the clues they had that might help them find Dom's bones. They took the information the medium told them when she first saw the notebook, and then they added information they'd gotten from the military about remains buried in the region where Homer shot Dom.
And the goal was to find his remains and get him back to the village cemetery.
Yes, we had a lot of hope that we would find his remains.
Early on, in the few minutes after the meeting where we planned where we were going to go and what we were going to do, they said that they thought that Dom and my spirit were linked. And that's why they thought Dom would be helping us on our search.
Dom's sisters and brothers and Homer, two American reporters, someone from the American embassy and a Vietnamese TV crew, all set out on a 2-day journey.
It was quite an entourage. So our goal was to go to the military cemetery and look for Dom's remains.
On the second day, when they were caravanning by van, the family got a call on one of their mobile phones. The Vietnamese authorities had a problem with Homer going to the cemetery.
They're very protective of their war dead, and because I was an American, they didn't know what my motives were. So because I was there, instead of being helpful, it turned out I was a hindrance to their efforts.
So Homer waited in a minivan outside the cemetery, in the thick, wet heat, while the family snuck inside. Several hours later, Dom's family reappeared, covered in dirt.
When they got out, they were just bubbling with enthusiasm. And they came up to me, and they had this cardboard box that you get shower heads out in from the Walmart or someplace like that. And then one of them, I think the older brother, took and wrapped a Vietnamese flag, North Vietnamese flag, around it. And then I realized what it was. And
one of his sisters held up her hands, covered in red mud.
And she said, I dug him up with my bare hands. I'm these hands are bringing my brother home. And she was, it was funny. She was crying, and yet she was also grinning from ear to ear at the same time.
Ta-da. When we came to the cemetery, so we all believed that it must be our brother.
Now, whether that was actually Dom or one of the other unknowns, we'll never know. But at least it gives the family closure to bring something back to the village. It makes them feel good. But with so many things happening on that trip the way they did, I have to believe it really was Dom's remains. I mean, I really do. After we had found the remains, we had to drive back to a place where we could get on a railroad car to go back to Hanoi. And the family said they would like to stop somewhere along the pass and have a little ceremony and consecrate the remains. They asked me if I knew where the spot was, and I told them, well, I didn't think I could remember that detail, you know. So I said, just pull over whenever you feel the urge, you know. Well, we drive and we drive and we drive and we drive, and they suddenly decide to pull over. There's just enough room for us to pull off the road. We walk around and look around, and it looks like a good spot. So they're setting up a little altar. They're putting joss sticks in the ground, had pictures of Dom and his brother and remains with a Vietnamese flag, North Vietnamese flag over it. The TV crew was with us, and they'd set up this big, heavy tripod. Must have weighed 40 pounds. Well, it's a clear day. About that time, a gust of wind came out of nowhere. I mean, a powerful gust of wind. Blew that heavy tripod over and broke the TV camera.
Thật ra đây là một cái kỷ niệm nó đặc biệt đến giờ.
This is a memory that until now I still feel shaken to think of that.
Có đặt vấn đề.
There was then a very strong wind, and the camera of the TV station got crashed down and it broke. So we couldn't do anything with that. The translator of the group said that he has a personal camera, so he took it out and we planned to use it, but it broke down too. Four cameras, we couldn't use any of them.
And meanwhile, while all that's going on, everybody just left me alone. I walked off by myself a little bit, and I'm standing there looking across the valley, remembering it. And I turn and I look up at the ridgeline. There was this concrete facing on the opposite bank to keep landslides from occurring right at the beginning there. I'm a little bit disconcerted. I'm a little bit emotionally overwhelmed. And then I walked a little bit further, and I got a clear sight for the first time of the top of the ridgeline. And there was the tree I had used as a marker when we went up the ridgeline. It's triple canopy jungle, and this tree was another 30 or 40 feet higher than the tallest tree in the triple canopy jungle. It was like an amazing tree. And what had happened is we had walked up there. Well, that's when we bumped into Dom, and that's where I killed him, at the base of that tree. And I'm standing there, and I'm at that point, I'm about to lose it, because it all hits me. I'm like, God, this is just, I can't believe they stopped at this point. You know, they had no clue, and they stopped at this point. To be honest with you, I thought I was wrong. I mean, I thought it couldn't possibly be. There was a couple of moments when I was, like, literally trembling, and then I just broke out of it and put it in the back of my mind, tried to not think about it.
He was too scared to tell anyone what he'd realized. The entire entourage began the long trip back to Dom's home village. First in the convoy of minivans, and then they boarded an overnight train. And the whole time, Homer was silently fascinated and disturbed by what he knew about the place they had randomly stopped on the roadside.
So later that night, when we got back to the train, Homer got very shaken, and he said, "I can't believe it." And he said that the place, the very place that we stopped in the afternoon, was a location that Homer met Dan.
The group got quiet. They rested the showerhead box with Dom's remains on the windowsill. Everyone said that they were both at peace and a little uncomfortable, nervous.
We were shaken. We were staggered too by after we knew that they kept calling my wife at home on phone and telling her to light the incense on my brother's altar, so they could help us. He would help us to go home safely.
Yeah, we took the long train route. You got to see the seaside on one side and the flat rice paddy lands on the other, and the mountains and the jungles. So you got to see basically the entire landscape of Vietnam. And I mean, I just sat there just absolutely spellbound. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, wow, what an incredible family. I mean, think about it. They opened their hearts and their arms to me in spite of the fact that I killed the youngest son. Think on my deathbed when it finally comes, if I have a slow death, which I hope I don't. I hope I get run over on my motorcycle when I'm looking the other way. But if I do have a slow death, I'm sure that as I'm dying, and I know I'm dying, I will be thinking of my family and friends. But I think in the moment that I die, in that split second before I leave, my last thought will be about Dom, because I'll be looking forward to meeting him. Oh, God. I'll be looking forward to meeting him, and I think we'll meet as equals.
There are many, many people to thank for their help in this story. Of course, Homer Steedley. You can find a link to his website at snapjudgment.org. And a big shout out to the Hong family and our translator in Vietnam, Chao Nho. We want to thank the folks at the Center for Emerging Media and Jessica Phillips for providing some of the tape from Homer's original visit to Vietnam. And lastly, enormous thanks to Wayne Carlin, who wrote a book on Homer and Dom and who helped us out with the research for this story. Find a link to the book, Wandering Souls, on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design for this piece was by Renzo Gorio, and it was produced by Anna Sussman and Eliza Smith. Now, please note, if you missed even a moment of that story, we've got the whole thing available for you right now. Just get the podcast, snapjudgment.org. When the Snap Judgment Full Circle episode continues, we've got the Call of the Wild up close and personal. And we've got some big news, Snap Nation, big news about the show. We think you're going to dig it for real. In Snap Judgment, the Full Circle episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Full Circle episode. Today, we're exploring stories that lead us back from whence we came. And for our next story, Jess Walsh, a mountain guide in Anchorage, Alaska, and her friend went off for a long trail run in the woods by the Elmendorf Air Force Base. What happened next was, well, Snap Judgment. Thank you.
It was beautiful and sunny, and my friend and I were at the height of our training, and so we're like, oh, I'm going to leave my water in the car. I don't need my coat. And I was like, oh, I don't need a cell phone. Oh, I don't need my bear spray. We're like, oh, we'll just do a quick 10 miles and we've got the dogs with us and my dog will make noise and she'll bark and we take off for 10 miles of it. You know, sometimes we'll run along and we'll be like, hey, bear, hey, bear, and just yell out in the open. I always love running in other places because I'm like, oh, I can be quiet. I don't have to yell or go whoop, whoop all the time. And so we were about halfway around the loop. So on the farthest end that you could possibly be, we come to this space where we have to run down a pretty steep embankment. We see in the trail that there's like a dog down there. And we stop. My friend and I stood there and we said, I think that's a wolf. There had been all these stories recently about the Elmendorf wolf pack. And this story of the school teacher, and she was running through town with her headphones in, and a whole wolf pack took her down in the middle of town and killed her. And all that was running through my mind the second I saw this thing right off the trail. And it was the biggest wolf I've ever seen. This animal was probably 175 pounds, and its legs were so long that its head probably stood to my armpit, and I'm 5'4". It was so beautiful. It was this white, gray. Had I been in any other situation, I would have considered that moment to be completely magical. But I was scared. I told my dog to heel, and she listened, and she stood right between my friend and I. It was sort of this stare down between the three of us and this wolf, like who's going to make a move, what's going to happen. And the wolf made the first move. The wolf took a step towards us. And so I pick up this big rock and I huck it as hard as I can. And it lands right by the wolf. And the wolf stops. And I thought, okay, good. Maybe we can scare this thing away. And then it takes another step towards us. So we both start picking up rocks and we start throwing them at this wolf. The wolf never looked at the rocks. The wolf never flinched. The wolf kept its eyes on us the entire time. We were starting to get a little like unnerved, obviously. And so, you know, we pick up this huge stick and we're both holding it and we're yelling. We're like, get away. As we were, you know, we were throwing the rocks, we were yelling and we're like, go wolf, go, go, go. We're using all these tactics that are drilled into you when you, you know, live in a place like this. And the wolf kept coming. Then we see a second wolf come out from the brush near the first one. And we're like, oh. I tell my friend, we've got to get up the embankment. We have to get up and try to get away from them. And we scurried up the embankment, which was really difficult because the pitch is super steep. Right at the top of the embankment, there was this tree that had a low branch. And so we run over to the alder and we turn around and those wolves are right behind us. I didn't hear them at all. They were silent. You know, all that was running through my mind was that school teacher. I couldn't reach the branch. And so I turned to my friend and I said, quick, give me a foot lift and I'll pull you up behind me. She steps out with her leg and I step on her leg and I grab the branch and I shimmy up. And then I reach down to pull her into the tree. And as I'm pulling her into the tree and her legs are hanging down, that big wolf jumps towards her. And as the wolf jumps toward her, my dog Winnie jumps in between her and the wolf. And the wolf got Winnie on the neck. And there was this huge, like a huge yelp from Winnie. And the whole time I'm pulling my friend into the tree, and we finally, both of us are on this branch. I'm sitting in the top of the tree and I look down to try to see how hurt Winnie is. And I can't see anything on her fur. She's black and can't see blood on the ground. After the wolf made contact with her, the wolf had stepped back a little bit from her. And she's on her hind legs and she's clawing at the tree and whining. And I don't want to come down in the tree because the wolf can jump that high. And I just start crying because I know I'm about to watch my dog get eaten, and I've left her. This is my husband and my first baby. But I can't risk my life to go down and try to get my 65-pound dog and up into a tree. I had a 2-year-old baby at home. I couldn't do that. I was saying, Winnie, you're such a good girl. I love you. Thank you for protecting Sarah. And I started to yell at her, run, run, go home, run. And she just kept whining and clawing at the tree and barking and whining. Then she sat down. And then she laid down. And the wolves had sat down on the side of the trail and were just watching her. And so she laid down and watched them. And we sat there like that for an hour. We had no food. We had no water. So we wait a little bit longer and we watch the wolves just stand up. Nothing prompted them. There was nothing that we did. They took about 5 steps back and then they sat down again and stared at us. And then they stood up like 10 minutes later. And they took about 5 steps back and then they sat down again and they stared at us. And they slowly worked their way out of our vision back into the other side of the trail, into the woods, by moving like every 10 minutes. It took like another hour for them to be where we couldn't see them anymore. Finally, we heard voices, and coming down the trail were 2 women running, and we were like, hey, stop, there's wolves in the area. And they stop and they were like, do we need to come get in the tree with you? And we're like, no, we're getting down. And so we climbed down and I was finally able to look at my dog, and there wasn't a scratch on her. I could find nothing on her. The newspaper ran a story on it without our names or anything. And the animal-human debate in Anchorage is hot. And I was afraid of what people were going to say if they found out. When we told the story to the Maine wildlife regulator on the base, he told us that that behavior was totally uncharacteristic of normal wolf behavior. I'd asked him, I said, what are you going to do? And he said, well, we're in the process of making a decision about what we're going to do about them. And then the next thing I know, like a month or two later, a decision had been made to trap and kill the Elmendorf wolf pack. And they did. They killed the entire pack that winter. I felt like it was our fault. And I carried that with me for a long time. I was a mountain guide. I should have known better. I taught people this stuff. 2 weeks ago, I was invited out to the trails where the incident happened. And I hadn't been back there in about 5 years. I hadn't been back there at all since I climbed out of that tree that day. I was standing there underneath these spruce trees, and I had this huge knot in my throat. It was because they weren't there. The wolves weren't there. The thing that sticks out in my mind the most is when we were trying to climb the tree, I was able to actually look into the eyes of this animal that had this piercing, ice blue, intense eyes. And, you know, if I was going to get philosophical about everything, I would say that's a pretty good vision of how nature is, intense and deadly, yet it was so beautiful all at the same time.
Thank you, Jess Wall, for sharing that story. We are happy to say that Jess's dog, Winnie, is still kicking and putting in the miles. Sound design for that piece, original sound design by Leon Morimoto, and the story was produced by Davey Kim. Now, Snap Nation, I am thrilled to let you know we've got some big news here at Snap's Orbiting Hall of Justice Storytelling Headquarters. Yes, because on Saturday, February 27, 2016, we're going to film our biggest Snap Judgment live show ever in beautiful downtown Oakland at the historic Paramount Theater, featuring brand new stories from none other than the closer himself, James Judd, the amazing Josh Healy, and more. Snap is so much, much, much more. It's going to sell out. And that's why we're letting you know here first. If you're in the Bay, or can get to the Bay, or know somebody in the Bay, or heard of somebody that knows somebody in the Bay, tickets are available right now at snapjudgment.org. It's about that time. But rejoice, friends, rejoice. Why? Because there's plenty more Snap where that came from. Subscribe to the amazing Snap Judgment Storytelling Podcast for full episodes and extra Snap stuff you cannot get anywhere else. Delivered to your phone device thingy, snapjudgment.org. On the Facebook, on the Twitter, Snap Judgment. Join the conversation, Snap Nation. Snap was produced by the team that always goes right back from where it came from. Let the people shout his name, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller brought a bag of beets. Anna Sussman brought a bag of cleats. Joe Speedy Rosenberg, Nancy the Compass Lopez, Davey Wetsuit Kim, the Renzo of the Gorio, our undercover Snap crew, Eliza Smith, Honor Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, and Matt Ducat. Jasmine Aguilera sprinkles salt on the whole affair. Now, do you ever dream where you went to work with no pants on? Well, it's not a dream if you're the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. No, it's a dicey situation. Much love the CPB. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could put on a mask, a cape, a tool belt, go fight evil, but you better remember that even though Batman didn't have any superpowers, he did stop by the gym from time to time, playa, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.